and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's reading is going to be the second one from Our Neglected Heritage by Gladys Taylor. And the chapter is entitled The Celts, and it begins with a quote from Aristotle. "Excessive want of fear has no name, but a man who is not afraid of anything, even waves and earthquakes, as they say the Celts are not, would be mad or insensible." Since the Celts are our subject, it is necessary to define what we mean when using this familiar but little understood name. To a student of church history, the Celts are the people of the Western Church, which was closely allied with the Eastern or Greek Church, but was overwhelmed during the early Middle Ages by the encroaching dominion of Rome. To an historian, the Celts are the inhabitants of Britain and Western Europe in the days before Caesar's Gallic War. To an artist, the Celts are the supreme designers, whose work is found in the illuminated manuscripts of the Celtic Church, and in finely designed goldwork found throughout Europe and extending further east, as archaeologists make fresh discoveries. To a philologist, the word Celtic applies to two groups of languages which, though spoken in the West, yet have their roots in the primary language of Central Asia. Any of these definitions may apply to our subject, but none will be complete. Our vision must embrace them all and take in a wider field, wherever the ancestry of our race can be traced. For they were the bringers of civilization and the advance guard of craftsmen and artists whose influence extends to our time. The name Celt is a mystery to historians. None have solved the puzzle of its meaning and derivation, or the language from which it comes. It was widely used by the Greeks as Keltoi, but they had taken it from some earlier source. The Greeks used two methods with foreign names. Either they translated them into Greek, if the meaning was known, or they rendered them phonetically into Greek letters, the method obviously used in this case, as Keltoi is meaningless as a descriptive word. The name itself is very old. In the Book of Jubilees, an uncanonical book of the Old Testament period, which is also called the Little Genesis, there is a reference to the mountain of the Celt towards the north. From any region of Hebrew sojourn where this book could have been written, the northern mountains must have been the Caucasus Range, and we may be certain that some of our ancestors would have been passing out of Asia into Europe when that book was being written. Among the Greeks, who refer to them frequently, the Celts were obviously proverbial for their outstanding bravery, which the Greeks regarded as positively foolhardy. Therefore, stories were written to illustrate this characteristic. At the time when Aristotle was writing, they were living in great numbers along the Danube Valley, and one reason why some of the later conquerors failed to advance far into Europe was the resistance put up by the Celtic tribes. When they were taken by surprise, the Celts would retreat quickly into the wooded regions that they knew well and then launch a counter-attack. Sometimes the name was hyphenated with another, suggesting that Celt may have been an all-embracing racial term which was combined with a tribal name to show which branch of the family was being mentioned. For example, the Celto-Scouts of the Caucasus, or the Celto-Iberians of Spain. They are mentioned sometimes, particularly by Roman writers, in conjunction with the Cimmerians, or the Cimmeri, Cimbri, Cymri, or Cymri, a fact which again shows a relationship between these two considerable racial groups. We will deal with all these matters in greater detail, but it will be helpful if the enormous ramifications of the subject are borne in mind, for in time they cover thousands of years, and in space they range across two continents. The Red-Haired People. And this starts with a quote from Dr. T. Rice Holmes' Caesar's Conquest of Gaul. "The prevalence of red among the Celtic-speaking people is, it seems to me, a most striking characteristic. Not only do we find 11 men in every 100 whose hair is absolutely red, but underlying the blacks and the dark browns the same tint, is to be discovered. If we wish to learn with any accuracy the physical characteristics of our ancestors, or even the pronunciation of their names and inflections of language, it is absolutely necessary to study the works of writers during the 18th and 19th centuries, or even earlier, if the subject is on record. This is not intended as disparagement of the finely detailed work of modern specialists. It simply arises out of a repeated accident of history. From the very beginning of our island story, the arrival of each new tribal group has brought in new physical characteristics and new accents or idioms of speech. The resulting mixtures have always tended to obliterate the existing habits, not completely, but sufficiently to obscure them for posterity. The basic qualities of race seen most reliably in the shape of skull and fairness of skin and eyes remain constant. We have ample evidence of ethnologists that this is so throughout the British Isles, but each incoming section of the race shows its own family characteristics. This has confused the British public into regarding themselves as a mongrel race. They have not consulted the ethnologists, but have drawn conclusions from the comparison of family features. One characteristic where the Celts are concerned is the large proportion with red hair, either bright auburn or darker chestnut colour. This is quite distinct from the yellow blondness of Saxons and Scandinavians. This seems to be a family trait, which marks the Celts as separate from his brethren of the other two groups. Mr. T.W. Rolleston, author of Myths and Legends of the Celtic Race, published in 1911, quotes a number of 19th century writers on this subject of the difference of colouring between the Celts and their yellow blonde brethren. The evidences were fast disappearing when they were writing and are even more difficult to trace today. Not only have the different clans in Britain moved around and intermarried as never before, but also the homelands of the Celts in Central Europe have been overrun repeatedly during the last 50 years, chiefly by Prussian and Slavonic peoples. Daniel Wilson is quoted as taking a Perthshire farmer as an example of the Celt and a Sussex farmer as representing the Anglo-Saxon, pointing out that both would be tall and fair-skinned, but with this distinction of hair colouring. Dr. Beddoe is quoted as examining the types discovered in the regions around Inverness, which were notable for their Norse ancestry, and declaring that there was not a trace of red in their hair, and their beards were absolutely yellow. Hair colour may be a superficial feature, but from the tribal point of view it is an interesting one. The subject of this book is prompted by the fact that the massive and easily followed migration of the Celts contributes very largely to our certainty that these blonde tribes of Britain and Western Europe were the people of Israel released from their captivity in Assyria. Others of the same race proceeded westwards much earlier and will be dealt with separately, but at the moment we are concerned with these bringers of culture and craftsmanship who made such an impact upon the Greco-Roman world during the Iron Age, from about 500 BC in Britain, but a little earlier in Eastern Europe. Among the Hebrew people, red hair was a characteristic of Judah. The words used in the blessing of Judah should properly indicate a brightness of colouring. It is one of the most mistranslated of verses, and it seems to be one of the instances where a mistake is made out of a persistent misconception. The assumption that the ancestor of today's modern Jews must have black eyes like the Canaanites in Jewry. The word used to describe Judah's eyes means brilliant, and in the Vulgate it is rendered as beautiful. There seems to be a link here with the fairness of the wives of the patriarchs. The description of Rachel as beautiful is again an adjective which could be rendered either as fair or bright. It is distinct from the words used of Leah as tender-eyed, immediately reminding us of brown eyes, which are always regarded as expressive. Indeed, there are a number of instances in Scripture where the word fair could have been used in the sense of blondness. If the translators had not been afraid to consider the possibility of the Hebrews being a blonde race, We have many a reference to the beauty of Sarah, which is reinforced now by the description of her in the seventh Dead Sea Scroll, where she is depicted, according to a Daily Mail report in 1956, in these words: her skin was pure white, her hair was long and lovely, her hands were long and slim. If the skin of Sarah was pure white, we are bound to admit that it is the type that goes most often with red or golden hair. At least it indicates racial blondness, which we are satisfied is the true colouring of the race of Shem and of his descendants, the Celts and Northmen of Western Europe. We should hardly expect to trace such descriptions of colouring further back than Sarah. Yet there is another ancient word picture that may give us a clue. It is taken from the fragment of the Book of Noah, which is incorporated into the Book of Enoch. It is dated by Canon Charles, the translator, as one of the two oldest portions of the book, and pre-Maccabean. Its value lies in the fact that it is old enough to contain a genuine tradition, perhaps even a fragment of writing copied from a contemporary description. Speaking of the birth of Noah, we are told, "His body was white as snow, and red as the blooming of a rose, and the hair of his head and his long locks were white as wool, and his eyes beautiful. And when he opened his eyes, he lighted up the whole house like the sun, and the whole house was very bright." Even allowing for enthusiastic exaggeration, this surely describes an unusually fair and blue-eyed baby. Within this race, then, apart from its general blondness of skin, there is a particular tribe which is noted for a redness of colouring that is handed down throughout history. The word ruddy, used in the description of David in the Book of 1 Samuel, indicates red colouring, which in the white race, where pink cheeks are normal, is most likely to apply to red hair. Similarly, the name of Rufus, as given to Pudens, the husband of Claudia, was always used for a red-haired person. Among the Jews, despite proselytizing and intermarriage with the swarthy Canaanites, one sees from time to time very fair-skinned and red-haired people who would appear to have inherited the colouring of Judah. Certainly, no person is born with such characteristics unless he has taken the appropriate genes from his ancestors. The laws of heredity are such that we know dark characteristics are dominant. As time goes on, the comparative blondness of a community will decline if a swarthy strain is introduced. The more the populations of Europe are moved around, as in the present century, the more difficult it becomes to trace the Celtic settlements. Here in Britain, as people travel more widely, it becomes impossible to determine whose ancestors were Celts, whose were Norsemen, and whose were Saxons. When the people of the northern house of Israel were taken into captivity, they were separated from their brethren of the southern kingdom of Judah. But when later the tyrant Sennacherib descended upon Palestine, he captured so large a portion of the southern kingdom that we are told he came up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. His cylinder records the fact that 200,150 of the people were carried into captivity. Only by a wonderful deliverance was the capital city of Jerusalem spared. It is natural to assume that these Judah captives were taken to Nineveh and joined with their brethren of Israel. We have some confirmation of this in the book of Tobit in the Apocrypha. This is the one book extant which is written by a member of northern Israel when living in Assyria. Tobit was of the tribe of Naphtali and a servant to the Assyrian king, and he speaks of Sennacherib's return to Nineveh after the campaign against Judah. He also confirms the death of Sennacherib at the hands of two of his sons, who after the murder fled into the mountains of Ararat. This may be a small point, but it does show that the obvious route for anyone wishing to escape from Assyria was into the northern mountains. It is reasonable to suppose that when the fall of Nineveh gave release to the captives, and they migrated through the passes of the Caucasus and into the Danube Valley, there would be many of Judah among them, and their most notable physical characteristic would be perpetuated among their descendants in the west. The findings of ethnologists among the Celts help to confirm the fact that this massive migration was indeed that of the major portion of captive Israel. As we have seen, the true descendants of Judah or Benjamin should be recognisably blonde. Many centuries of racial admixture have caused darker characteristics to become dominant, but if we turn to the writings of travellers who visited Palestine before 1917, we shall find them surprised by the noticeable blondness of some Jewish families which never left the Holy Land but remained there throughout the centuries. Professor Sayce, on his first visit to Palestine, tells us in his book Races of the Old Testament, "I was struck by the fact that fair-haired, blue-eyed children are to be found, alike in the plains and in the mountains, in the crowded cities and in the most remote villages between Gaza and El Arish, the frontier town of Egypt. It was impossible not to notice the numerous examples of fair-complexioned, red-haired men with whom I met." He also described them as dolichocephalic, or long-headed, a sure sign that they once belonged to the same race as ourselves. The famous traveller Lady Burton in The Inner Life of Syria speaks of visiting a prominent Jewish family in Damascus and finding that they were white with blue eyes and fair hair, like any English people. It is in Syria and Lebanon that the Druze have lived for many centuries. They were a closely knit Jewish community, though recent events have tended to scatter them, and their most notable characteristic in a land where dark-haired inhabitants predominated was their red-brown hair and beards. In her book India of the Princes, Rosita Forbes describes the white Jews of Cochin. They are undoubtedly Nordic, and not only white in the generic sense of the word, but fair, she says. According to their own account, their ancestors were exiled by Solomon in connection with the building of the temple in 1000 BC, either to supervise the supply of materials from the local Ophir, or because they were suspected of participating in the opposition, which in the succeeding reign led to the revolt of the Ten Tribes. These Jews, at the time of writing during the 1930s, were still using ancient vestments and service such as that conducted in the temple. Professor Jean-Jacques Reclus, the 19th century geographer, speaks of finding a colony of Russian Jews on the shore of the Gigaean Lake, who were tall of stature, with blonde complexion, pale blue eyes, and yellow hair. All these comments show that the true Hebrew type is pure Nordic, and far removed from the popular conception of today, when some have even had the effrontery to describe our Lord himself as coloured. He was a true child of Judah, and the old masters who depicted him with light brown hair and blue eyes were surely very near the truth. We will give the last word on this subject to a modern writer who is himself an American Jew, Lewis Brown. In his book, How Odd of God, he used these words: "How the idea arose that all Jews have long curved noses is a mystery. Certainly it was not true of the ancient Hebrews, for, judged from the carvings on archaeological remains, they had short, straight noses. And significantly, so do most of the Bedouin Arabs today. And these Semites are supposed to have maintained themselves in a fairly pure state since ancient times. It was the Hittites in what is now Armenia who were strikingly hook-nosed, and they were as foreign to the Hebrews as the Swedes are to the Italians. Undoubtedly, we Jews, in the course of our ancient wanderings, did come in long and close contact with the descendants of those Hittites, and a sufficient number of us may have thus acquired the spectacular Hittite proboscis to give the impression, once we reached Europe, that all Jews were thus adorned." When Ezekiel, reproving the remnant of Judah in Jerusalem, said, "Thy birth and thy nativity is of the land of Canaan, thy father was an Amorite, and thy mother an Hittite," he was speaking of something literal. The merging of cultures. And this starts with a quote from Nora K. Chadwick. "Both their religious and their personal poetry is marked by a refinement of feeling and a sympathy which is incompatible with persecution or cruelty, and which puts integrity and kindness above all formal standards of conduct. As previously stated, the title of this book is being used in the widest possible sense to embrace all members of our race. The inhabitants of some of the supposedly Celtic regions of the British Isles are descended from families who actually had no part in the great Iron Age migration through the river valleys of Europe. Most of the Irish people had already settled in the Emerald Isles before the Celts proper had entered the Danube Valley in Eastern Europe. They came in tribal groups from the Mediterranean area between the Pillars of Hercules, sailing northwards past the Iberian Peninsula, rounding the coast of Brittany, and arriving on the Irish coast. This movement began in Neolithic times and continued throughout the Bronze and Iron Ages. What many fail to understand is that the different times of arrival did not mean difference of race, but simply tribal distinctions within the same race. It is known that Canaanite Phoenicians also came on trading missions. They seem always to have sailed wherever the Hebrew mariners went, but their settlements constituted a foreign minority, never becoming dominant, though they were to be an irritant in Hebrew society at all times, as God declared in his law. Having the family types in mind, we can say of the Irish colleen with black hair, fair skin, and blue or green eyes that she is no stranger to the ruddy Celts, but her forebears were probably the earliest settlers in the West of all the civilized tribes, speaking the most ancient form of Indo-European language, closely akin to the mother tongue of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. The Norse clans of the northern highlands of Scotland, impressively tall, with bright blue eyes, made a separate, later migration through the Baltic lands. The Welsh, who still name themselves the Cymry, pronouncing it in the same manner as the Cymry recorded on the Behistun Rock in Assyria, also migrated across Europe, but following in the footsteps of the Celts, and recognised as their brethren and often included with them in Roman records. Some modern ethnologists even list the Saxons among the Celtic tribes, because the close relationship between the two groups is at last being acknowledged. The race of Shem was always very conscious of family, in biblical times. It is not surprising if their descendants, whether in early Greece or in Britain and Western Europe, continued the habit of remembering genealogies and dividing into clans named after noble ancestors, like the Numidians after Numid or the Milesians after Milesius. This could well be the way in which Israel was destined to forget her God-given name during the time of her dispersion. Names were certainly remembered, but such a multitude of them as to confuse historians through all the subsequent centuries. The result of this confusion has been the tendency to regard tribal names as defining language groups and to leave the problem of who is related to whom still unanswered. Yet there is a direct method of determining race, which might well be dismissed by scholars as too simple. If the tribes, possessing the same basic qualities, a common head shape and colouring, also speak languages derived from the same parent tongue, that makes a starting point for our investigations. Now that archaeology has produced artefacts over the entire route of migration, if the arts and craftsmanship of these migrating tribes coincide as to the style and method, and this is repeated in tribe after tribe and period after period, we reach a point where the likenesses are too strong to be merely coincidental. George Bain, the supreme specialist on Celtic design, whose own patterns were based very effectively upon the methods used by the designers of Celtic jewellery and manuscripts, studied the history of all related crafts very closely indeed. In an article in the magazine Scotland, published in 1934, he summed up his findings in these words: "Influences upon Celtic art are to be found from eastern Siberia and throughout Russia and the whole of northern Europe, and along the great rivers leading to the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, wherever the waves of migrating northern people found passage and substance for themselves and their animals, centuries before Greece became a nation." Since these words were written, Their truth has been reinforced by many more discoveries, including the wonderfully preserved treasure of the Scythians in the frozen tombs of Siberia. Shortly after, a schoolboy discovered a rich hoard of objects inlaid with gold, silver, and enamel, with typical Celtic zoomorphic decoration on St. Ninian's Island. A cache of equally wonderful jewelled work, carried out in the very same style, was discovered in a remote spot west of the Caspian Sea. It was reported in the Illustrated London News with a double-page spread of coloured photographs, but because there was no writing to indicate who the hiders of that treasure were, it was unnamed and presented as an unsolved mystery. It is surely more than coincidence that metal workers in places thousands of miles apart should have been using identical methods. Apart from the remote possibility of British craftsmen sending such a quantity of gold work to that distant region in the Middle East, the only conclusion is that the craftsmen themselves migrated from east to west, bringing their skills and practicing them in all the regions of their settlement. George Bain gives a further assessment linking these art forms with all the regions of Hebrew wandering. Recent excavations in Mesopotamia, Asia Minor, and Egypt show the connection of Celtic art with the East earlier than 3000 BC. Then he adds, Lady Flinders Petrie tells of a brooch of Pictish Celtic workmanship found in an ancient Egyptian tomb. Notice that the design is so precise that it is recognised as specifically Pictish. The period when the Celts were living in great numbers in the Danube basin and the Alpine regions was most notably from the 5th to the 3rd centuries BC. Many references to them are made by Greek and Roman writers at a time when their art was so distinctive that archaeologists gave it the name of Lachen after the Swiss region where this style was first discovered. And we know immediately upon hearing this name that it represents fine metalwork of a particular style that we recognise as Celtic. Now, so much has been discovered that the period has been divided into Lachen A, B, C and D, all filling that short era of the Iron Age. Arrian, in his Life of Alexander the Great, speaks of the great Macedonian entering the river mouth and sailing his powerful warships filled with infantry and archers up the Danube, where he took the first of the Celtic towns by surprise, but afterwards met with stiff resistance from men who knew their territories, retreated into the wooded mountains, and descended upon the Macedonian army from vantage points which they had chosen. Arrian describes the Danube in these words. This river is the largest in Europe. It drains a greater tract of country than any other, and forms the frontier to the territories of some very warlike tribes. Most of them are of Celtic stock. Indeed, the source of the river is in Celtic territory. Then he proceeds to name some of the nations concerned. Some we know, like the Sauromate and the Getae, whom he names as the Immortals, and finally, at the mouth of the river, the Scythians. Arrian speaks of Alexander being visited by envoys from Cyrimus, king of one of these nations called the Triballians. In no case is there any indication that these Celtic people are savages, quite the contrary. At the same time, an interesting account is given of the arrival of men from a tribe which had not yet reached the Danube. The Celts from the Ionian Gulf also sent representatives, men of haughty demeanour and tall in proportion. All professed a desire for Alexander's friendship, and mutual pledges were given and received. Alexander asked the Celtic envoys what they were most afraid of in this world, hoping that the power of his own name had got as far as their country, or even further, and that they would answer, "You, my lord." However, he was disappointed. For the Celts, who lived a long way off in a country not easy to penetrate, and could see that Alexander's expedition was directed elsewhere, replied that their worst fear was that the sky might fall on their heads. Nonetheless, he concluded an alliance of friendship with them and sent them home, merely remarking under his breath that the Celts thought too much of themselves. It is easy to see in this account the independence of the Celts, also their courage and refusal to fear man, which was proverbial among Greeks and Romans. On his way to the Danube, known to the Greeks as the Ister, Alexander passed through Thrace and across the beautiful river Hebrus, surely named by the Israel people, and set out on his attempt to conquer the Celtic lands by the route followed previously by Darius, who had also attempted to add Europe to his conquests. In fact, it seems from the accounts given first by Herodotus and then by Arrian that it was the Celts who cut short this attempt to dominate Europe by two of the world's greatest conquerors. These ancient descriptions of the Danubian Celts accord well with what we know of our ancestors in Britain, so that difference of place and time seems to fade away as we read them. Herodotus includes the Thracians among them, speaking of the Celtic Getae as a branch of the Thracians. This is a particularly significant point of view of the fact that the ancient Gaelic epic, the Almanac Duan, tells us of the Picts, Thrace was the name of their country, till they spread their sails. After they had resolved to emigrate in the east of Europe, Agathisi was their name in the portion of Eshley. From the tattooing of their fair skins were they called Pecti, the Picts, the tribe I speak of, understood travelling over the sea. These Celtic Thracians, apart from the Getae, had several tribal sections under other names, but one of them, which they seem to have brought from Greece, is the Caledonians. Ammianus Marcellinus, a Greek writer who served under the Roman rule during the 4th century AD and gave much detail concerning the various nations in the empire, says, "The Picts were divided into two nations, the Dicaledones and the Verturiones." In Robertson's Historical Proofs of the Highlands, their identity is summed up briefly. It has been said by the Gael of Alban, or the Highlanders, that they are the representatives and descendants of the Caledonians, that noble race of men who with success defended their country and maintained their freedom. To this, the Highlanders can have no claim whatever unless they are the descendants of the Picts, who were the Caledonians under another name. The Highlanders of present Scotland have ever called their land Alban, and themselves the Gael Albanac. The Highland name of Caledonia immediately reminds us of the Greek legend of the Caledonian boar. Nelson's Encyclopedia gives a cryptic definition under Caledon, scene of the hunt of the Caledonian boar, Ovid Metamorphoses, Book 8. This legend covers also the magic or sacred boar of Gaelic, as of a Cymric legend, also sacred to the Teutons. This reference links together Greeks with Gaels and Cymri, and also with that mysterious people of northern Europe who were allies of the Cymri in their resistance to Caesar, actually defeating him on one occasion, who appear in Roman history as the Teutones. Unfortunately, the name of Teuton has been given to so many Germanic tribes, including Prussians and Franks, that the identity has become confused. Nevertheless, it does seem to be true that the original Teutonese were a branch of the Celtic tribes. They were neighbours of the Jutes, living between Jutland and the Elbe early in the Christian age. So, we follow our ancestors all the way from Asia to Britain, dividing into many nations and then combining together, but always recognisable by their love of fine decoration and art forms, combining curves and spirals in intricate patterns. They left behind them objects of daily use, deposited along the route, as though God were inspiring them to deposit their waymarks as proofs of identity. Artifacts of such great beauty as to cause archaeologists to gasp with astonishment. Thank you very much for listening, and we will have more readings from our neglected heritage in the future.